The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, I just want to announce, so this is a celebration of Spirit Rock a little bit, and by talking about emptiness, compassion, and being here for the day. And Spirit Rock's going to do two more of these kinds of events. And one of them is coming up next week at in San Francisco. There's the San Francisco Vipassana groups, Spirit Rock connected groups, are banding together. And they're going to do Saturday from 10 to 5, a day of celebration, meditation, and community. And it's being taught by Eugene Cash and Howie Cohen, who are the two big groups up there in San Francisco. And Vinny Ferraro, who also has a group in San Francisco. Is it as big? Vinny's, I don't know. Vinny's talked here. He's kind of coming out of the Noah Levine lineage. So it's Dharma with tattoos. And Pam Weiss. And so, anyway, if you want to celebrate some more. And this is a Dana event. It's free. And then in September, Guy and I will reappear for another benefit or another celebration. September 13th. Your name is here. And Jack Kornfield, Sylvia Borstein, Guy Armstrong, Deborah Chamberlain-Taylor, Sally Clough, Anna Douglas, Gil Fronsdale, Wes Nisker, Mary Grace Orr, Donald Rothberg, and Tisha Bell. So that's a big gathering, all in one place. It's at Spirit Rock on September 13th. I guess that's the formal, or official, or the most official, most concentrated 20th anniversary celebration of Spirit Rock. And also, in terms of benefits and all that, something that inspires me quite a bit is that many of you, I know Stephen Levine and his wife, Andrea Levine. Stephen Levine was one of the one of the foundational teachers for the Western, our Vipassana teaching world that we know. In some ways, according to Jack Kornfield, Stephen Levine was partly responsible for the initial introduction of metta and the way that it's taught in our scene, much more than almost anyone else back in the early, mid-70s. And at least Jack says he got a lot of it from him, that the emphasis on the heart and the warmth. And whether that's true or not, Stephen Levine and his work in hospice and his books and his retreats he taught was very important for many of us. And both his wife and him have gotten elderly now, and they have almost no money. And so there's been all kinds of efforts to raise money for their medical bills and to support them in a variety of ways. And so there's going to be a benefit at Spirit Rock on June 14th with Jack Kornfield and Franz Stefsky and Jay Utal, Deborah Chamberlain-Taylor and Julie Wester it's called The Heart That Holds It All, Transforming Loss, Death, and Difficulty into Grace. And so, wonderful things. One of the things I've discovered is that to do too many Dharma activities is undharmic. So there's wonderful, it's really marvelous, wonderful Dharma things to do. And it's wonderful when people are interested, but do them in a measured way. Yeah, including coming here. So, let's do a sitting. And so taking a comfortable, alert posture, gently closing your eyes. Since after lunch is often a sleepy time, it can be helpful if you sit up a little bit more upright than you normally would, giving some emphasis the alertness of your spine. Feeling the weight of your body balanced on your spine. So you're not, the center of gravity is not forward or behind the spine, but kind of traveling through it. And you're traveling down to the bottom of the spine, near the lower curve, bottom of the lower curve. Maybe to give a little bit of strength, maybe a teeny, teeny bit, millimeter or so of accentuating that lower curve can sometimes be helpful. So some feeling of strength, the base of your spine. And then traveling up your spine to the space between your shoulder blades, feeling the spine there. Then very gently, again maybe just a millimeter or so, to pull the spine there in, so the chest a little bit maybe is more open, the heart is a little bit more open, available. And then keeping your spine alert, upright, taking a few long, slow, deep breaths. Feeling connected to yourself through your breathing. And then letting your attention, letting your breath return to normal, and let your attention settle within. Having your ability to be attentive, be aware. Perhaps let it mingle in your body with tenderness or care, compassion. And as you breathe in and breathe out, the awareness of your breathing in and out, and your care, your tenderness, can all mingle together. Breath, awareness, and compassion. One breath at a time. As part of this meditation, taking advantage of whatever settled and calm state you might have, I'm going to offer you some contemplative or reflective questions, topics. You can take in the questions and reflect on them, think about them as you wish, or just let them kind of move around inside your mind and see what bubbles up in response. So first, bring to mind some experience you've had in your life of someone who was, some situation where you felt touched, moved, be the recipient of someone's compassion for you. Some situation where the compassion or the care felt clean, helpful. Can you remember the circumstances, the situation you were in? Could be a minor issue, some stranger helped you at some point, or it could be a big issue that someone stepped up and helped in a big way, or recall the time, the situation, the event. Remember the person, how the person related to you. So remembering this situation where there was a clean form of compassion directed to you, what were some of the characteristics that helped this become a clean act of compassion? What is it like? What ingredients come together, or what ingredients are absent when you receive compassion from someone and there's no stickiness to it? There's no problems with it. It just feels right, helpful. And then turning this around, see if you can remember a time in your life where you had compassionate care for someone else. And see if you can remember a time when you, the best of your abilities, the best, closest approximation, that this act of compassion felt clean on your part, felt wholesome, healthy. Remember what the situation was like when you had this clean compassion for someone else. Remembering how you felt, what happened. And again, give some thought now. Reflect a little bit. But what are the ingredients that come together? What characterizes clean compassion? How would you recognize it? What would be absent? And when you consider clean compassion, the kind of compassion where you feel just good about, feels right. And you contemplate the existence of such compassion in the world, in others, or maybe in you, yourself. If you really kind of take that in and appreciate the existence, the possibility of this clean compassion, how does that make you feel? Knowing that it exists in this world. So if you're willing to go along with this term, clean compassion, would someone like to share a little bit? What are some of the ingredients or characteristics of clean compassion?
No expectation of reciprocity.
So no, it's not an exchange, like getting something back. Okay, thank you. All the way in the back, maybe speak up. No judgment and no shame. Thank you.
Responsive.
It's responsive, as opposed to
not doing anything. If something, an action is called for, then compassion responds.
So if the action is called for, there's this natural response.
Right, spontaneous.
Okay. Straight back. So to recognize that compassion is not the same thing as pity. And what is pity?
Pity is putting yourself at a different level of feeling. Putting yourself.
It's on. It's working. Just have it close to the mouth.
What's that? I would view pity as putting yourself at a different level than the other person and feeling sorry for them, which immediately changes the relationship, rather than compassion is feeling with them, being with them in whatever sorrow arises.
Beautiful, thank you. Here in the front, move. The mic. Use the mic.
I think there's a certain evaporation of feeling of separateness.
So evaporation of separateness when the compassion is clean.
Yeah, it's a feeling of being met.
Feeling of being met. Nice. Dick? Healing. So clean compassion is healing. Thank you. Yes?
A clearer seeing of the suffering.
So a clear seeing of the suffering. So clean compassion is a clear seeing of the suffering. That,
Which
is really simple. Clean compassion is simple. Thank you.
The person offering the compassion isn't trying to look good.
The person offering the compassion is not trying to look good. Look at me, how compassionate I am. Yeah.
Question. Is there dirty compassion?
There's sticky compassion. And there can be a motivation to help someone, but connected to that motivation is I want all my neighbors and friends to see how wonderful I am. I want my status to be high.
Is that actually a definition of compassion?
I think that human beings can have mixed motivations, multiple motivations at the same time. And I think there can be a pure feeling of wanting to help someone, but it goes along side by side with other baggage. So rather than saying that, you know, if you're helping someone because you want your status to improve in your community, most people, that's not compassion. If that's the only reason, that's not compassion, to look good. But there can be mixed. People can have multiple motivations. And one of the things about this complicated compassion, the synonym, the opposite of clean is not dirty, but is complicated or sticky. And complicated would be, for example, if the motivation is not really to alleviate someone else's suffering, but the motivation to help is to alleviate one's own suffering. So people have anxiety and distress around suffering they see out there, and they really want to take care of things because they're really trying to change what's going on inside of themselves. So I wouldn't call that clean compassion, because it's not about the person, that person. It's about yourself more. So it looks like compassion. I want to make sure she's satisfied.
I'm perfectly satisfied with your answer. I just noticed that in the Tibetan tradition, they don't define compassion has its own definition without the need to add an extra word such as clean or complicated.
Yeah, beautiful. I think so. I agree. And clean compassion is not a technical word. I just thought, I just thought that having that little adjective would kind of help with the heart and help with kind of make clear what we're trying to get at here. And yes.
I also think that compassion has a quality of accepting of what is without a need to change it.
So compassion has a quality of accepting what is without the need to change it, even though the compassion is the motivation to try to change something. It's kind of a double thing there, right? So the lack of expectation. So one more, all the way in the back. Wait for the mic.
You got a soup kitchen that's designed to do religious evangelization. That might be compassion, but it may also be trying to change people.
So does it, for some people, that wouldn't feel so clean. It'd feel like a sticky then or something else. Mixed motivations there.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose that it depends on the person providing the compassion and the person receiving it, kind of.
Thank you. Okay. Well, maybe you'll get more chance. Let me say a few things, if I may. I read something recently about compassion that certainly made a lot of sense to me. So, you know, there's a lot of scientists studying compassion now. It's become a field. Just like the happiness research, there's compassion research. And one of these researchers was saying that that compassion doesn't inherently exist in people. What inherently exists is the potential or capacity for compassion. And there's a difference between the two. And certain conditions bring forth the compassion. And certain conditions cover it over, or make it, or not cover it over, but just don't give birth to it. So, you know, a seed has the potential to become a plant, but the plant does not exist in the seed. But there's right conditions and the plant becomes the seed. So rather than saying that there's some kind of metaphysical, pure compassion that resides in our hearts, I think, at least according to the early Buddha, the early Buddhism, it's more like compassion is a capacity that we have, and we can develop it, we can grow it, we can nourish it and support it. Some people certainly have the experience of relaxing in a deep way and feeling like they discover compassion within them. Oh, lo and behold, there it is, as if it's innate there. But I think it's more like it's not really there unless we nourish it or support it or make the conditions for it. And one of the beautiful aspects of Buddhist practice is the way in which it creates the conditions for the growth and support and development of compassion. If we don't appreciate, one of the primary supports for its growth is the appreciation of it. I almost likely have been thinking that we become what we appreciate. Or to little bit, to a small degree, we take on some of the qualities of what we appreciate. So if you appreciate violence, that has a very different effect on us than if we appreciate nonviolence or compassion. And so to appreciate compassion and its value is one of the things that lets this beautiful quality grow. To say that we all are compassionate by nature, as if it's already there, maybe does us a little disservice, because it kind of suggests that we don't have to spend any time cultivating, growing it, nourishing it, nurturing it. We have no responsibility in relationship to it. Oh, I already have it, I don't have to do anything. But maybe there's a beautiful way, a healthy way of taking responsibility for our compassion, and seeing it as a beautiful capacity that can be developed, and then developing it. And I think we don't have to leave it to chance. Some of this will grow, I think, almost naturally out of Buddhist practice itself. And some of it will happen as we create the conditions for it. So in my situation, when I came to Buddhist practice, I had no interest in compassion. I knew what the word meant, kind of. But it wasn't my, using vocabulary. I never thought of using the word in any kind of conversation. And no idea that I, had any real important relevance. So I sat and meditated for years, number of years, with a lot of my own suffering. And I suffered a lot. In the Zen tradition I practiced in, we were not given any tools, practices, how to be with our suffering, except just be with it. And I got to be with it, and be with it, and be with it, and be with it. And in retrospect, I'm very grateful for that time. Because I wasn't so smart either, so it never occurred to me it should be any different either. I just sat for the suffering, I was just supposed to sit. But what happened with that presence, being present, certainly I was letting go of all the ways in which I was trying to change it or fix it or fix myself. Just be here, be present with it in a very simple, direct way. And with time, it started to soften me and relax something inside of me. And at first, and what I realized in retrospect, when I looked back on those early years, was that I was being compassionate. Rather than getting enlightened, I was getting compassionate. And I think it was so precious, so valuable to me, that I was getting more and more compassionate by the practice. And some people will focus so much on enlightenment, that's what I want, awakening. But maybe it's as important to get compassionate, really good and compassionate. And for me, in my situation, it was just to be that presence for the suffering. And at first, I didn't think I needed it. But what happened was my unconscious knew I needed it. And so I started gravitating to compassionate things around me. And And I got really interested in the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin. And I would kind of look, whenever I would draw pictures of it and do different things and kind of had some on my wall and looked at. And it didn't reflect on why I was interested in this. I just, nice art. You know, it's nice to have this nice art on my wall. But really, it was this, I was looking for compassion. And I would gravitate towards people who I'd see who I thought were really compassionate. And I would just kind of gravitate towards them, just to kind of notice them, appreciate them. And there were times when even I would feel that even the breeze of the wind against my cheek was an act of compassion towards me. And then over time, more and more, this the armor around my heart started to melt away. And what was left from all this time of working with, being with my suffering, was a heart that was more and more compassion, more love. And I'm very grateful for this. It felt very sweet, very wonderful. It felt very significant for me that this happened. And now I think of compassion as something which is inseparable from, if I dare use this kind of non-Buddhist language, from who I am. It isn't like, you know, that, you know, this is maybe, it could seem very kind of arrogant to say it this way, so you'll be forgiving of me. Because I don't mean it this way, I hope. But it's almost like I am compassion. I don't mean some big, I'm not that compassionate, but, you know, but, you know, but it's like, what I'm trying to say is it doesn't feel like it's something that I add to me at this point, or something that I have to think about, or something that's, you know, it's like second nature. It's like, this is kind of like, you know, what's going on, is what I mean. So a lot of that came from just being present, being mindful. That happened a lot with the Zen practice. When I did Vipassana practice, the mindfulness had the same impact on me, effect on me. But then I wasn't suffering so much. And then, as the mindfulness helped soften the heart and open the heart for me, then what got born out of that space, or what came up out of that, was loving kindness. So Zen, for me, brought forth compassion, and mindfulness brought forth the loving kindness. And I'm sure for other people it could easily be turned around. It's like one does it. Just my circumstances that it was like that. And it said that one of the sources of compassion is the experience of emptiness. And little bit we understand that when we're empty of greed, hate, and delusion, empty of ambition, and empty of all these barriers and defenses and heart and things, the heart is much more sensitive. And the mindfulness is much clearer and cleaner, take in much more directly what's there. So we feel the suffering more of what's in the world. And as we feel the suffering in the world, if we've let go of enough of our judgments and worries and anxieties, despair and reactions to it, then we're not going to be motivated by those unskillful responses. Rather, we're more likely to be motivated by wanting to alleviate, wanting to be helpful in some direct way. So as we become emptier in this kind of way, it's many people find the experience of compassion, loving kindness comes forth much more clearly. There seems to be, as far as I know, so far, two primary sources for how people are compassionate. One is that it comes with development and all that, but it's triggered by contact with suffering. As lofty as compassion is, and great ideal it seems to be, the very unfortunate thing about it is that it comes with contact with suffering. And so, you know, allowing yourself to connect to suffering, not being defensive, not trying to escape, not trying to push it away, but having a very, very open relationship to suffering is a very important part of any kind of Buddhist practice at all. And part of that then is learning about ourselves well enough to be able to tell the difference between empathy and anxiety. Empathy versus despair over the suffering we see. It's said that that empathy and compassion, when it's clean, if I'm allowed to use the word, tends to bring with it a sense of rightness. even though the situation is wrong, this person's suffering, it shouldn't be. There's something about that response that has a right feeling to it, as opposed to feeling personally, some personal anxiety or horrified, you know, or, you know, that doesn't open up some wound of our own. So the mindfulness practice is a very important practice to help to work through all the different reactions and responses to clean up our act enough so we can be present in this kind of cleaner, more direct way. Then with that, so when we contact suffering, then there's a greater chance that we have empathy. That's the first thing. And empathy is a beautiful thing because empathy means, in a sense, kind of feeling with something, feeling it as if it's almost our own. As opposed to like pity, where you feel it not as your own, but the poor, weak person down there. And then from that empathy, there can be a number of responses. And one of the responses is compassion, which is defined as the combination of empathy and wanting to help, wanting to make a difference. So one of the ways that compassion is it's triggered by the contact with suffering, when we have that ability to meet it in a clean way, clean enough way. The other way is a little bit more mysterious. And this is where, in some Buddhist traditions, they talk about how they talk about the commingling of emptiness and compassion. And there's something about the experience of emptiness that seems to have it within it, or part of it, or synonymous with it, a sense of compassion. It doesn't require necessarily contact with the world of suffering to feel compassion. So when the mind has a deep contact with emptiness, so that our clinging is, we're freed of clinging. There's no more clinging, grasping. The mind is very empty in that way, very still. There seems to be, there's like this amazing sweetness in there. And that sweetness is called compassion. It's compassion without an object, because it's not towards any suffering. It just kind of, it has a quality. Some people call that quality its sweetness or something like that, a compassion. I don't know if that's always the case. I don't know if it's universal. Maybe sometimes it's loving kindness or love, or I don't know what it is. But these are the two sources. Is contact with kind of a clean enough contact with suffering, and then this clean enough contact with emptiness is what gives birth to compassion. And then, but what are some of the supporting elements that support the growth and the appearance of compassion in our lives? So I want to tell you a story. I apologize to IMC people, I've heard this a couple of times now. That Daniel Goldman talks about in his book, Social Intelligence, of an experiment done at a seminary, where 40 seminary students were given the task of going to the library and preparing a 10-minute sermon. And half the students were given told to write a sermon on the biblical story on the Good Samaritan, who helped this person who was down and out in the street. And the other 20 were just given random passages in the Bible to do a sermon on. The students did not know they were part of an experiment. They just thought they had to give the sermon. Then every 15 minutes, they were sent from the library to where they had to give their talk. And on their way there, there was an actor. But they didn't know that. They didn't know it was an actor. But the actor was in a doorway, down and out, groaning and moaning, oh, you know, laying down. And then the researchers were behind a bush, I guess. And they were going to see who stopped to help the person, who was going to be the Good Samaritan. And the researchers found there was no difference between those who did random passages in the Bible and the ones who were going to give a talk on the Good Samaritan. So in other words, thinking about and preparing a sermon, a Dharma talk, on this kind of caring for strangers and all that, didn't necessarily make people more prone to be helpful. That's very humbling for a Dharma teacher. But then they ran the experiment another way, and they told some of the students that they had to hurry, and because they're going to be late for their. And other ones, they said, "You have lots of time. Take your time." And they found that a great majority of the students who were in a hurry did not stop, but a slight majority of those who were told their time would stop. There was a correlation. So there was no correlation with the theme, but there was a correlation in how much time we had. So what's more important, studying theology or Buddhology or giving yourself more time? And so one of the conditions for things like compassion is giving ourselves time. And if we're doing too many things, being too busy, multitasking and all these things, it might be very efficient getting a lot of things done in the world, perhaps, but it might prevent the possibility of some deep, shyer responses, motivations to come from us. And one of those is compassion. So if you want love and compassion to be a motivating force or a force in your life, one of the very simple supports for that is to slow down, give yourself more time to allow that to happen. And I know there can be tremendous challenges to that because the demands, the lawyers, not the lawyers, but the lawyers of the mind. Maybe it's not fair to say lawyers, but the politicians of the mind will give you all kinds of reasons why it's so essential to do a lot and get busy and take care of things. And I kind of think one of the primary things that will give birth to these beautiful qualities of the heart is giving ourselves time. So another quality of emptiness, empty time. To give yourself some time to be empty. And to some degree, that's what we do in meditation, hopefully. If you have too many techniques and practices and too many things you're trying to accomplish in meditation, then you're also maybe blocking the ability for this innate capacity of sensitivity, of empathy, of connection to arise. And so much can arise on its own. But it's not just a matter of on its own, it's also how it's supported. And I would like to give you a couple of studies that were done on how plastic compassion is, how malleable it is, and how it's shaped by causes and conditions around us. And these are studies done of children and the cultivation or the presence of compassion in kids. And they found that by the time kids were 3.5 years old, they could feel empathy and compassion for fellow kids. And what they found was that the children who grew up where they had secure attachments, this is not Buddhist language now, felt secure attachment to their parents, they were the ones who were much more likely to have compassion at the age of 3.5. Those who had insecure attachment, insecure connections with their parents, were much less likely to feel compassion at this young age. They also found that children, I don't know what age, but children who were raised with kind of discipline through power, reprimanded and told, go to your room, or kind of using an assertion of power, that they ended up being much less compassionate than those kids who used whose parents would explain to them, when you hit Joey, you see that, how hurt he is? As opposed to, you hit Joey, go to your room. So those parents who explained, took the time to explain things. So to both these studies, to me, are an indication that how we are, and the influence on our lives, has a big impact on how compassionate we are. The third study was that of, they compared how the level of compassion in an individual with how compassionate their parents were. Now, you could argue it's genetic, but they did find that the more compassionate the parents were, the more likely their parents were. And I think some of it might be genetic, but some of it might be just the example, having the models. And I know that for me, there was a formative moment in my life around compassion, or that kind of care, that was a very small thing. Maybe it's almost too small to worth mentioning in terms of the worldly example. But maybe it came just at a formative moment in my life. and it changed me in some way. We were living in Italy, and my mother had a habit of stopping and helping out when there was automobile accidents, which there were a fair number. And that was nice. But one day she went and bought a large box of first aid stuff. And she said she got it because she wanted to have it in the car for when she stopped to help some accident situation. And that little thing of buying a box of first aid stuff, that touched me. Why would she do that? That model, that example, kind of opened something in me that in some ways has been valuable and meaningful for me the rest of my life. So a small example, a small model. So having models is helpful. Having a kind, considerate explanation of things rather than using power is helpful. And feeling secure and safe in some deep way is helpful. So all these things are things we can cultivate for ourselves. We can become our own model. If we're interested in compassion, then act on your compassion. Live from that place whenever you can and become your own model. If you're interested in compassion, then talk to yourself in a nicer way. I think I guess you don't have to explain that more. And the last thing, I think, if you're interested in compassion, and this is where it ties again with emptiness, is cultivate a sense of safety, deep, deep abiding safety. Feel safe. So safe that the idea of being safe disappears. And I think that emptiness, at its heart, is the safest place to be. The safest realization. It's a tremendous place, tremendous experience of safety. There's plenty of people who maybe have that experience of emptiness and they don't think about safety as being part of it because they don't need safety. So it hasn't occurred to them. But to have this very deep sense of peace and well-being where the heart, deep inside itself, feels secure. And from that security, then comes the ability to be a willingness and capacity to connect, to feel empathy, to respond, to act in the world. If we're feeling insecure, it's a lot harder to come that way. So a big part of Dharma practice, and it's not an easy thing, I'm not saying it's easy to be a teacher sometimes because you just say things, but it's a lot harder to do it, so I want to just make that clear. But it's hard to do the inner work, to do the practice that creates the conditions of deep inner safety. Where we really certainly feel safe from ourselves, which is a big step, but also safe from any kind of heart, any kind of harm that can be done to our heart or to that essential place inside of freedom or luminosity or transparency or wakefulness or something. So a lot of the Buddhist practice is about beginning to create these conditions of safety. So again, ethical practices, precepts, help create safety. The practices of loving kindness and compassion are partly there to help create conditions of safety, security. Mindfulness is preeminent. In Buddhism, mindfulness is considered one of the preeminent ways of being protected, being safe. So what is it about emptiness? What is it about abiding without clinging to anything? What is it about not resting the mind, the heart, attaching the heart and the mind to anything at all that makes it safe? That's the question. You don't have to answer that question, but we can now take it open if you have questions or comments you'd like to make or... anything? What would you like to, any responses? Yes, please. Is the mic nearby?
Mm-hmm. Can you contrast loving kindness with compassion? It seems similar sometimes.
Yeah, they're similar. And different teachers will emphasize different relationships between these. Tendency in Theravada Buddhism is that loving kindness is like the base motivation or the base attitude. And then it's basically an attitude of wishing happiness for others, wishing well-being for others. And that well-being can take the form of happiness, safety, health, a variety of things, ease. So it's mostly, and it's said to be, whereas compassion is when that care, that love, that is loving kindness, meets suffering, then it morphs itself into feeling the empathy with a person's suffering and wanting to alleviate that suffering. May that person be free of their suffering. So rather than saying, may you be happy, it's more like, may you be free of that suffering. Just alleviate that suffering. If someone is really happy already, then you don't necessarily wish them more happiness because they're happy. So then you have mudita for them. You have sympathetic joy. So love takes the form of sympathetic joy. And the analogy that's given in the ancient texts is that when a baby is born, as a baby, then the parents, basically the baby's healthy and good. Then the parents just have a lot of goodwill, loving kindness for them. They want the child to grow up the best for the child. They just want the best. If one of their children grows to be, grows up a little bit to be the kid and becomes a cripple, becomes somehow ill, quite ill, then the parents would have compassion for that person. Rather than the community, like a baby blessing, people are mostly celebrating and wishing the kid well. That's loving kindness. The person is sick, the kid is sick, and then there's compassion. Then the analogy goes on and says, well, then when a child reaches young adulthood and success with career and family, it's all going well initially, then there's a lot of sympathetic joy and delight in that. That's the right feeling. And then once the child grows up old enough and their career is well established, their families are well established, whatever the things, then the parents just have equanimity. Just taken care of, I've done my job. we know they're okay, and then there's much more this feeling of equanimity. The love takes the form of equanimity. Does that answer your question, I think?
What do you think, or in your view, is the relationship between self-compassion or compassion for self and compassion for others? And do you feel that the former is necessary for the latter, or is there any relationship, important relationship between the two, besides difficulty?
I suppose, depending on the person, there's all kinds of ways of answering that question. I feel a little bit shy to answer it kind of in a simple way, this is how it is. But the if a person has a lot of suffering, a lot of anxiety, a lot of distress, I think it's really beautiful and maybe necessary, helpful, for that person to have self-compassion. And maybe for someone in a lot of distress, it's going to be hard for them to have compassion for someone. Some people, some of them might have a hard time compassion for others unless the self-compassion is there first. But I can also imagine there's some people for whom they can't do it for themselves at all. And it's very healing to do it for someone else. And once they've done it for someone else and develop it there, then they can at some point do a little Aikido move and bring it back to themselves. So it kind of varies how it is. And then there are some people who have no inner real distress. That's not really an issue. So they don't need to have self-compassion. Yeah.
Can you hear me? Something that you just said, because working with people with trauma and anxiety, And definitely when there's a compassion for themselves, then it's actually we're able to begin to work with people that have done some things to them that they've been victims of. And it's pretty neat to watch that. But on the other token, when someone, I notice sometimes just having compassion for this person over here and not for themselves, and I ask them how that feels, and it goes, it feels good. And that's a sensation. I said, that sensation is within you. And they never look at it that way. So I go, that compassion is your compassion. It's not that you're just giving it to that person. It's actually within you. They're just not recognizing it yet. So it's interesting just going back to what Guy was saying, you know, with that felt sense.
Yeah, reminds me of a Stephen Levine had a conversation with someone where when something like this, the person was talking about something like, you know, how hard he was on himself and how he can't have any compassion and he wish he had some compassion for himself. And Stephen Levine said something like, that must be really difficult. And that just broke the person's heart. And started crying, and that's when the compassion was there. It came.
Yeah, I feel like some of this is so close that we're talking about. It's like taking the hair and trying to split it. Like, is it this or is it that? And it's so mixed together, you know, even in the suffering. I think it's like the one thing that I've recognized, you were saying that when you really do feel deep suffering, and I've been learning that more and more from my work, how more open I have become. It's kind of blown me away. My willingness to go into suffering, how it's changed me, you know, more so in what you said. And it was, I think it was the thing Ram Dass that kind of said that. He goes, my willingness to go into my own suffering never knew the joy and freedom that came from his own willingness to feel that in himself, which is kind of what you're really talking about here. And I've been finding that.
Great. Thank you. So straight back. Yeah. Okay. Is a light on underneath on the bottom? If you look at the bottom of it. There should be a light on it.
Okay. How's that? Yeah. I've been dealing with my family lately in a difficult situation. And I've been finding that very often there's a conflict between self-compassion and compassion towards others, that there's a point where trying to do both at the same time is challenging. So I just wanted to know if you would address that. Where you feel like you have to take care of yourself, but you also have to take care of someone else, and they're sort of equally compelling.
I don't know what to say except good luck. I appreciate that it's a struggle that sometimes we have, and it's not sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes, you know, it's kind of clear where the emphasis needs to be, because sometimes it's clear that if we don't take care of ourselves well enough, that we're not going to be helpful for others at all. And so we have to do the inner work or take care of ourselves first. Sometimes it works out the equation differently, and sometimes it's hard to know. But one of the things I like about I was going to say Buddhist practice, but maybe we shouldn't say it that way. You know, practicing in our life is we learn from trial and error.
The hard way.
I appreciate the dilemma. So, Bonnie, over here.
I wanted to get back to something, Gil, you said at the beginning of this talk, who are you doing this for? And is it really for your benefit or for someone else's? And I was thinking about my work in grief counseling, where my intentions of being compassionate are always very pure. But sometimes the byproduct is it empties me of my own suffering. And is that selfish? I mean, I can go into it knowing I'm going to feel better after I do this because I get healed from healing.
Right. I suspect that if it was selfish, the motivation, it could be. It could be people do compassionate things for their own sake. They're not really concerned about the other person as much as doing something for themselves. So if it has a kind of self-centered kind of motivation, it's not going to be as helpful for you.
But what if it's, if you're really clear that your intentions of being compassionate are very pure,
yeah,
but it's just a byproduct, then that's okay?
I would celebrate that.
Yeah.
I think, great. Yeah. And not only that, I think it's actually okay, maybe healthy, to actually want our compassionate, hope that our compassionate response to the world also benefits us.
Okay.
And as I read the teachings of the Buddha, the early teachings, that the Buddha doesn't have the divide between altruism and selfishness that makes up much of certain currents of modern thinking. And often we read that back into Buddhism, that, oh, we're supposed to be altruistic and not selfish. But the early Indian tradition talks about the mutual benefit of all this. And I saw it much more integrated, that as we benefit ourselves spiritually, we are then also benefiting others. And as we benefit others, we're benefiting ourselves. And we don't have to make some kind of seal between the two worlds. It's okay to want some benefit for ourselves as we help others and have that develop ourselves and grow ourselves. But if it's done selfishly or with greed or with clinging, that's going to interfere with that mutual flow of benefit. So we have to have the mindfulness of ourselves to know what's actually going on, and then have to make a decision, work and resolve the places we feel there might be some attachment.
Thank you.
So maybe one more here.
I guess I've given a lot more thought to loving kindness practice than to compassion and compassion practice, and I'm just reflecting on that in this discussion. And I guess I'm thinking about how with doing a lot of loving kindness practice, one gets very in touch with just not wanting others to suffer and also not wanting oneself to suffer. And I guess I'm thinking about how orienting that can be for compassion, like that, because it's just the very presence of suffering that brings up the compassion. It's not a certain type of suffering, a certain person suffering. And so, I don't know, I guess I just wanted to add that as kind of a resource in terms of a way of orienting around compassion.
That's beautiful. And I love the word orienting, because some people will orient their whole life around that. That's kind of the orientation that defines their life, is the orientation around suffering and the response to it, compassionate response to it. It's what, you know, gives meaning to their life. And my last words before we take a break. I think it's helpful to differentiate between empathy and compassion. Empathy being the feeling, the contact with other people's situation, their feelings, in the case of suffering, feeling their suffering in a way. And compassion, the motivation to do something about it, to help. And then when we feel that motivation to do something about it, what do we actually do? Because this world is full of suffering, and we can't respond to all of it. So what do we do? Hopefully we respond some places. So I have a couple of responses to this. One is that, a few responses. One is, that when the suffering is immense that we encounter, I feel like the heart almost has to respond in some way. Like after 9/11, I think that to not somehow been changed by something like that, I think it does a kind of disservice to our hearts, because it's such a big impact. That's my sense. I changed my life because of that. What I did was I started a chaplaincy training program because of that. As a response to that, and but I think having some place, not necessarily responding to all the places, but choosing one or two or some place that this is my area, And then when you see suffering elsewhere, and that motivates you, it doesn't necessarily get you to change that situation, but it inspires you, it gives you energy to put more energy and focus on your area. Let me do my area even better. That's one. The other is kind of an unusual response to suffering and this whole compassionate thing. And that is, rather than translating it into helping someone or something, it's take that energy and channel it into our own practice. And try to get down to the roots of our own hearts, our own minds, and transform that, heal that, change that. And I think it's a very powerful thing to say, oh, there's suffering in the world. I'm going to respond to that suffering. But the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to try to get to the bottom of it in this heart here. Because hopefully there are people in this world who do that work. If no one does that work, I don't know, then I'm worried. It's really important that some people do it. So the motivation to practice, very strong motivation to practice can come out of that contact with suffering as well. So that's my thoughts.